today I'm talking to Marc Louvion, who's Product Hunt's Maker of the Year 2023. Marc is a shipping beast, and his most recent project, Ship Fast, allows other founders to launch their products just as fast as Marc does it. Ship Fast has seen massive success over the last couple months, and our conversation actually turns into a founder brainstorming session at some point, where we try to figure out where Marc can take his project from here. This episode is sponsored by Acquire.com. More on that later. Now let's get shipping with Marc. Marc, welcome to the show. I am talking to the Maker of the Year 2023. I think this is awesome. Congratulations. How does it feel to be awarded such an honor, such a title? Did you expect that?
I had a little glimpse of it. Last 2023 was a very, you know, like a lot of things happened, shipped a lot of startups. But that backward, like 2 years back when I just got started, Product Hunt was kind of like the Coliseum. I was seeing it as the thing, you know, for makers. And so that 2 years journey has been pretty impressive, and the title was, it was just so cool.
Yeah, that's really nice. I found this, it's really cool to have this title and then to get that title as somebody who hasn't been around like for decades as well, right? You got started, you really shipped for a couple of years, and now you're here building all these amazing things. Is Product Hunt still something that you like use in every single of your products and every single of your launches?
Yeah, man, I literally shipped an app yesterday on Product Hunt.
Yeah, how is that doing? What is it, Zenvoice? What's the name of that thing?
Yeah, it is Zenvoice.io. It's a little no-code tool for Stripe to avoid paying the fee for Stripe invoicing.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And it was doing well. I always launch on Twitter as well. I make videos that I think I remember you were one of the first person who made a comment on that Joe Rogan video. It was a year and a half ago. And I'm forever thankful for that. And doing well.
Yeah, I want to kind of talk about this because I was looking at this yesterday when you launched, and I was thinking, this guy not only is building interesting products, but he's building them with this focus on the launch on Product Hunt itself. Like, I don't think you could build a tool that could not be launched. I think you would always like gravitate towards something that you can actually put on Product Hunt. How much of a priority is it being launchable for you if you build something new?
It is 300%. It is my entire focus. And that's why I try to avoid shipping proper startups with more like one feature of what a startup idea I have in mind. Because I have packed a bunch of failed startups in the past, and I would drive my mind crazy. I would spend a year building a product that nobody would ever want. And so now my marketing is mostly launching. And I see how people react. And I've seen that with some product like ShipFast, I have really good feedback and traction from the launch. And then I go all in on it. And sometimes with other products, then, you know, I make a couple $100 for the launch. It's nice, but there's no real traction. There's nothing that people are really excited about. And so I would just keep the product running and I would move on to the other one to avoid making the mistake of spending another 6 months on something that people would probably never want or use.
Yeah. Do you have a time limit for this? Like if a product that doesn't, like how long do you work on a product before you think, okay, maybe it's time to pivot to something else?
So there are different stages. In the last year, it would be maximum 1 month. I'll never spend more than a month on it. Now I get to see people's questions. People are giving me feedback. People are sending me emails. So I give some kind of pre-validation. I kind of know something that people already want. And so I would this year spend more time building those products because I know there's some kind of need already somewhere.
Yeah. So with this pre-validation, do you also have kind of a pre-validation, like before the launch itself? Do you try to build up some kind of, I don't know, on Twitter, in your community, some kind of buzz before you even put it up on Product Hunt?
I do actually for Zenvoice. So the last product I launched, I built it live on YouTube. I set up my stream. I have my little microphone and I go live every morning and I would spend 2 to 6 or 8 hours live building the product. And then I get people's feedback. So they are like, sometimes they help debug my code, which is really nice. Sometimes they give me marketing like headlines, IDs. And also I get also some potential customers there who are like, oh, this is cool. You know, why don't you add this feature or that feature? This is my pre-validation thing.
Wow, this is awesome. That is really cool. Streaming has always been really interesting. I feel like as a coder, I'm always super scared to stream. And I had Rox Codes on the show, and he streamed a lot in the past. I think I had an interview with him on his podcast. Like, we were hanging out on his Twitch stream for 4 hours and just chatting while we were diving like from topic into topic. Streaming is a different world, right? It's just a more engaging kind of thing. When did you start streaming, and why did you start streaming? This is a pretty big deal, right?
And I think this is the kind of question I don't even know how to answer. I don't know. I think I wanted to have a different approach to building in public. And like you're doing with the podcast, you're showcasing some funders who've done well in the past. I tried to have a different approach than just 280 characters on Twitter. And building live is the most, real things you can ever do, because there's this thing where you see some people who made it, you don't know the entire story behind. And even though you see a tweet, it's hard to relate for some of them. And so I was like, well, if I go live, this is 100% me. This is not edited, not scripted. And so, yeah, transparency is something that, it connects people, it sells. And I wanted to give it a try. I think I've done it 3 times, once a year ago, maybe another one 6 months ago, and recently, like last week. And it's been doing well. Like, and even YouTube is also pushing those lies. I have a really tiny YouTube channel at the moment. I think it's about 5,000 subscribers. And each live would get at least 2,000 views, which is nice for a video that's not edited and that forces me to sit at my desk and actually produce some code.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it is very interesting to watch. I feel like watching somebody act as an entrepreneur, as a founder, is wildly different from just seeing those, as you said, 280 characters of a summary of their work, right? You get to this transparency, the authenticity. I do wonder, because you're now somewhere at 76,000-77,000 followers on Twitter as well. Do you struggle with staying authentic in front of such a massive audience at all? Or is it easy for you?
Yeah. Recently, I don't think it's about, at least for me, not about the number of audience of people. It's about coming back after making a product that was talked about a lot on Twitter. It's very hard. I feel like some people would have expected, or maybe I just have expectations for myself, and I feel like I have to make the next hit. I cannot ship something that will fail. And I self-assure myself with that. Yeah, that's pretty much where I am at the moment.
That's interesting. I love this, because that's how I felt for the last couple of years, right? We sold our business in 2019. Then I started writing. And I mean, writing is also hard. Coding is hard. Business building is hard. Everything is hard if you really want to do it well. But writing is easier because, people don't pay you a subscription fee and you have to keep writing, right? It's not the same. It's not the same as building an indie business. So I kind of didn't build businesses for a while because I felt, well, I'm just going to keep writing, going to build a newsletter, going to build a media business, I'm going to just find sponsors and do advertising, make money a different way. And then I started building again. Didn't work out too well, right? Like the first couple projects that I was doing didn't go that far or as far as I wanted to or as far as I did in the past. And I felt like, ooh, should I even code? Like, it's nice to hear you feel the same kind of feeling, because it's obviously stupid, right? Like, these things, you never know where it's going to go. You just have to put in the work. So how do you convince yourself to still go through this, to still put your work out there?
I think I built a little identity in my head of who I am, and I try to turn off the emotion and just be like, okay, I like creating stuff, and this is who I am. Since I'm a kid, I create stuff. I'm just going to keep creating stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if
that's an easy answer. Yeah. I mean, maybe share some things from your past that you've created, like pre indie hacker. Like, if you said you started as a kid, what did you create back in the day?
I think like a lot of indie hackers, Legos, playing in my room, building them all day. Nothing else matters. Huts and dams. I'd go into, we had a little garden. My parents, I would have some little logs and I would make little huts in the garden or in the forest. And then I discovered coding, at university, at the time where I was not interested in coding, but I kind of started to understand a little bit what is the internet and what is coding. And then after university, I had to do something. I just didn't want to become an engineer, which was my graduation. And so I tried to, you know, find back what I was doing as a kid. So building stuff for the current world, so the digital world. And I found with coding to be this kind of like self-fulfillment of creation, of tool creation, yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. I agree with that. Like, coding is magic. I don't know how to say it any better, right? Coding is just magic. And the fact that you can create magic for other people to use to be wizards all by themselves, that is so powerful. I think that I would like to talk about ShipFast. That is the product that I've been most impressed by recently. Although we'll see where SendVoice goes over the next couple of days, right? You never know. But ShipFast has been, it just blew up like crazy. And can you explain to me why you build it, what it is, maybe that's important too, who you build it for, and where this journey has been going over the last, what is it, like 6 months?
It's soon to be 6 months, yeah. Yeah, so this is a code base for programmers who want to create startups. It includes payments, it includes emails and all that. Back then, it was just a way for me to ship faster. So it was 6 months ago. I already, at this point, built about 15 products, and I was doing the same thing over and over. You set up a landing page, you create a domain name, you had customer support, you process the payments. I was like, oh, I'm going to create my own boilerplate and I'm going to make it available for people who want to eventually do the same. And I spent probably a week gathering the code, making a little documentation, and I pushed it live before going on holiday to Hong Kong. And then I just woke up to the launch, and at the time I was making maybe 3,000 to 4,000 a month, and I would wake up to the launch with something like 3K already made within 24 hours. And from that day, it created some kind of, I don't know, loop or whatever. And just things kept going up, and it has been making about $50,000 a month for the past 5 months. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I've noticed that in your Twitter bio, that number is just amazing, right? That's for a product that doesn't even have like recurring revenue, right? This is just amazing sales. Can you talk to me maybe about the choice that you made here? You have, I think you have two prices. You have one like $169 for like a normal version, and you have the $199 version that includes like lifetime updates and that kind of stuff. I find that pricing choice really interesting. First off, it's just pay once, use forever. That is already pretty cool. But also this very slight difference between prices. Can you talk maybe about the psychology that you put in there, like the reason why you priced it that way?
So the people who are listening to this know that this is pure luck and randomness. I had no idea what I was doing back then. But I think it worked. So the idea is to have some anchor price where you have a price that is slightly cheaper than another one with one or two or less, three features less, but it creates some kind of anchor. People would be like, okay, so that's $169 is the price for the product. And so that $199 makes sense afterward because you're anchored to that $170 or $169 price point. Whereas if you have just one price, how do you compare that with something else? Like how many apples is that? Like, you know, it is hard to understand for people, what is the value of such a thing? And that helps a lot with this. And I decided to go with a one-time payment because, you know, as you said, like it's much easier to sell a one-time fee for something than it is to sell a subscription. If your product doesn't have a really good recurring value, there is no point of charging a recurring revenue.
Yeah, I think it's also just a wonderful idea for this kind of product. Right, this product, you don't have to pay for hosting. I mean, you have to host it somewhere, but you don't have to pay for ongoing hosting of other people's stuff. You provide files. I mean, from your marketing copy, you don't provide files. You provide an experience, right? You provide like a way for people to ship, which is nice. And I like this. I really enjoy your copy. Gotta say, I was reading through that page and even just because I'm interested in what people build, and the way you phrase it is like, you don't buy the code. I mean, obviously you buy the code, but you buy effectively, if you buy your own time, You buy your own time back. That's what this product is. I find this really, really cool. You really speak the language of the people that you're helping. And that's probably because you use this yourself, right? Do you still use it in all your products? Is this still like the boilerplate for everything you do?
Every time. And that's how I avoid building unwanted features. I have tons of feedback about potential features for SheFast. And what made it successful is because I built it for myself. And if I listen to all those feedbacks, I'm going to build a very complex boilerplate. And I do not do that. Instead, I use it for myself. And every time I see something that is useful, I'll add it to SheFast. So I shipped ZenVoice yesterday using SheFast. And out of ZenVoice, there were two UI components that I made for the landing page that were nice, that I thought I could reuse later. And so I went back to SheFast and I added those two components. And that's kind of my filter to avoid, you know, focusing on unwanted stuff and build only what matters.
That's really cool because you also get to use these new components now in your old projects if you ever wanted to, right? That is awesome. What a genius way of building something that just feeds back into everything else you're doing. That is really cool. I love what you've done on the homepage too, where you show just how recently you updated the product. I think this is a lesson like for indie hackers who still want to communicate with their audience like one-to-one, who really want to show, hey, I am building this. This is not some nebulous company somewhere. This is me. I'm the person behind it. Here's the feed of like the GitHub commits that just integrates into your website. Is that something that you, did you choose that as like marketing tactic, or are you just a nerd who wants to show that you integrate your GitHub comments into your website there?
I would say it's the spirit of the community where we'll build in public. The t-shirt is saying is you share, you're transparent. We relate, we're a close little community. And so we can relate to people that way. So it's closer to a marketing strategy than me being a nerd. I think like the YouTube lives, building in public, I think it's great to show everything that you're doing, the good, the bad, the secrets and all that. And so that's part of the reason I made this open. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's really cool. I think like it really speaks to me as somebody who judges or has to judge, like most of your users, they come to your website, they look at it and they want to figure out, is this legit? And is this going to stay with me for a while, right? Because for $200, you want to invest that money into something that's going to stick around. Showing the update frequency and just how recent the latest update has come, that is a pretty solid positive signal to the developers that you're serving. I think that feature in particular stood out to me as genius. I'm going to steal that idea at some point. And I think if only more of us would do this, just to share with their target customer audience just how much effort they put into this, right? Then I think that would communicate much more clearly why and how you're building this. This is really cool. Are you building some kind of beyond the product, which is code, right? Are you building a community around this too? So that's not just a code base there, but also people who can help each other? Is that a plan? Are you doing this?
Yes. It was not expected at all because I'm not a community type person. I spend all my time in this bedroom here and I don't talk to barely anyone. But someone mentioned, do you have a Discord community? And I was like, why not? Let's give it a try. And I opened a Discord and I made it part of the premium plan. And people started to join and like share like crazy, help, like debug each other, upvote each other's. I was like, oh, wow. Me, for someone who has never been part of a like close community like this, only Twitter, I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. And I kept, you know, adding more channels so people can talk about marketing, can talk about debugging, life in general, updates, work in progress. And it's been doing really well. The SheFast community now is, I think, about 1,000 something members. And you have every week, you see new project being launched on Product Hunt. And man, this is pumping. This is a kind of like the end reward for me. It's like, oh, if I see people actually shipping stuff, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really cool. I love that this is like a little side result of you building this product. Now, all of a sudden, you've brought people together. Isn't that awesome? I think this is just the most wonderful thing. Do you intend to take this further as a business? Like both SheFast and this community, like not just in terms of monetizing it, but do you intend to build more around this, like consolidate it?
I'm at a point where I don't really know. Do you have any clue how I could update or upgrade this?
Well, let's brainstorm a little bit. I'm thinking a lot about the Small Bets community by Daniel Vassallo, right? That is a very focused community on this one aspect of we all want to build different things and we want to see which one of them makes it and we focus on that one. You kind of are in a very similar niche, just in a more technical way. You are where people start their thing and they try to make it grow, right? They try to grow it to a point where this little thing that they quickly built turns into a real business. What Daniel has done, and that's probably the one thing that I would recommend, is turning the community into a university. Because Daniel has been hiring people to teach, right? I was on his, and I'm going to be at the end of February, going to be there again teaching about building a media business. And he has Justin Welsh talking about LinkedIn, right? He's bringing all these experts in that can help the existing community just with a lecture. And then he saves the lecture as a recording and offers it for free to anybody who joins the community. You know, like that turns the community into this constantly growing treasure trove of knowledge that new people can tap in, and old people, they get new lectures every now and then. I think turning it into university, that's a move, and it's easy. Like, you're well connected. You could easily get your indie hacker friends and the people that you know in the marketing world and all of that, just give a lecture. Then Daniel Vassallo pays them, but you probably don't even need to do that. There's a lot of just interest by indie hackers to find other indie hackers to look at their stuff. So, you know, I think that's how it could start for you.
Oh, that's smart. Yeah, it's a very smart move. Yeah, this guy is really doing really well.
Oh,
that's super
sure.
awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, smart. I think this is probably the part where my developer mindset comes and tells you, like, hey, bro, we need to build here. We cannot do some other. The operational thing part of it is not for you, Mark, you developer. But I think this is a really smart way. That's probably why the community is growing. So it's so big now. I hear it everywhere.
Yeah. And the thing is, I think Daniel has hired people to help him out. I think Louis Basai is like a co-founder, like a after the fact kind of co-founder situation there, just sharing the operational workload. But that's the one thing that may be a bit problematic at this point. If you're a developer and you want to code, then sitting in webinars, like, is not the same thing, right? Like sitting and listening to people teach in the community, putting effort into maintaining the community, that obviously is time that is not spent in your IDE. So you'll have to figure out, how much of a developer do I want to be if you want to build this even bigger? Or do you want to find somebody who's kind of a community manager or a community leader, somebody who does it better than you, but will still listen to you? You know, somebody like that, and give them that role and have them build the community while you keep coding. That's really the balance you need to strike as a solopreneur, right? Because you still need to be fulfilled in what you do. Daniel has no problem with that, but might be more problematic for you. Have you thought about, like, giving up the reins to somebody else?
It has crossed my mind a few times. And I think there is a part of me that really wants to say solo. I think you can only go as far as you want being solo, but at a certain point, and I feel like where I am now, I'm kind of happy to stay solo, and not have this part of me that doesn't want to work with people. I'm making this podcast like I am someone who doesn't like people. I love people. I just don't like the operational part of it and having deadlines and yeah, stuff, you know. Yeah, this is I have to probably find if I can find a fit with my personality and expanding the business at the same time. Yeah, it's pretty hard.
Honestly, I think it's a very common, I wouldn't even call it problem. It's just a common reality for indie hackers. Like, for people, like, the indie is important, right? We want to be independent. We don't want to be beholden to somebody else. It's bad enough that we have to listen to our customers, right? It's bad enough that they're the ones controlling what we do. Now, having other people in the mix, that's just complicated. I understand it. I feel it. Honestly, that was the reason why I never hired anybody for Feedback Panda, the business that we built, my girlfriend and I built back in the day, and then sold a couple of years later. And this is a cautionary tale, because my reluctance to hire, my reluctance to get people on board into the business led to me almost burning out completely. Like I was mid burnout when we sold the business. We sold the business mostly because I couldn't keep doing it anymore, right? This might not be where you are right now, and I hope you never get to that point, but I convinced myself that I never wanted to share this with anybody else, right? I convinced myself that only I could do what I'm doing because I'm the world's best developer for some reason. Obviously not true, but that's what I told myself. Nobody else could do my work. And then it kept growing and growing and got bigger and bigger, which is wonderful, but I was still just me. And I was the only technical person in the business. My girlfriend was doing operations. She was doing like the design and the marketing and all that. And still we were both overloaded, me a bit more than her. It got pretty horrible. So there is value in thinking of other people and bringing them in to a certain degree. There is also value in doing it yourself. So I don't want to scare you with this. I just want to give like my perspective on this because that was pretty dangerous at some point. I hope you never get there.
Yeah, no, I think I can imagine. Yeah. I mean, it's probably because you have, I think you were having like a proper software so people would use it every day. For me, as you said, it's like they get the code. It's kind of like a course. So once you get the course, you could get a few support, customer support emails here and there, but it's still quite light. So probably not experiencing any of all the hard work you've had tried. What would you say is, did you have mostly customer support, like bugs on the site or emails from clients, or is it something like technical that was hard to manage because you had a lot of traffic or something?
Well, I guess that's a good question. Most of customer support was just people who had little issues, right? We were serving kind of it was B2B, but it was also B2C. Like we were serving freelance online English teachers. They were not very technical. They were just sitting in front of their computers trying to get their webcam going and whatnot. And we helped them with some kind of admin stuff on the back end. So we were with the browser extension integrating into their online classroom. There were some technical hiccups, but it was mostly just when our side had a problem or when the connection, the browser extension had a problem. A lot of people, we had like 5,000 customers at any given point. Everybody would write at the same time. That was the stressful part, like dealing with the avalanche of customer service. Not even the individual problems, because most of the time it was like, yeah, we're fixing it. Just check back in 5 minutes, right? That was the answer we would give. But I would give this answer like 150 times. That was the problem, right? It was the flood. And had we hired somebody, just anybody for customer service at that point, just to be like the first line of defense, and say, yeah, I'm going to go through these 150. You keep fixing that bug. I'm going to tell them they're going to be better in a couple minutes. That would have saved my sanity much more. And you're right. It was a SaaS business. We were serving customers constantly, 24/7 worldwide. That's different than an info product, which is why, like I said earlier, I have not built a SaaS in a long time after we sold. I wrote books. I made courses, right? I did all that stuff because precisely the customer service load is minimal. Like with books in particular, Amazon KDP, like you put it on Kindle Direct Publishing, Amazon deals with all the stuff, right? They sell it for you. They print it for you. Even the eBooks they put on the Kindle, you don't have to deal with any of these issues. Even Gumroad, people download it. They do it all by themselves. Like it's very, very low support. But also, I guess, the upside of it is also a bit lower, right? That it's not that you all of a sudden have thousands of customers paying you hundreds of dollars a month. It's just people paying you $5, $10 every now and then. So, you know, different deal. But that's kind of why I'm trying to suggest something that is not a SaaS to you at this point as an extension of this, right? If you take ShipFast further, if you start building little SaaS tools, you can do this, but then you get into this whole customer service cycle again, right? Then you need to be present all the time or you need to hire. So I guess a community of just lectures where people... You can build the community website. I think Daniel Vassallo did that too. Like he built the platform that houses the Small Bets community. There is a Discord. I think now he's using the once thing that the Basecamp people put out, like the Campfire, I think is the name, right? Of their chat system. But Daniel still has all the videos and all that stuff integrated into smallbets.com or whatever. I forget. But it's his own platform that he built. It's just... he doesn't sell the platform. He sells memberships on that platform, which is a different kind of business. And memberships, I think, are also easier to handle. Or it's not even membership. It's a lifetime membership. It's a pay once, you know, use forever, just like your product is at that point. It could come with the code. I think I love this idea of you building a community that sits on top of an info product that is actively maintained. That makes the community more active. And that also allows you to just grow the value of the community. Then people would probably buy the product just to be part of the community. That's very interesting.
I get that a lot, yeah. I get that a lot. I don't know how to code, but I want to be part of the community.
But that's the point where you've tapped into something, right? That's the point where you know, okay, people value this connection and they would buy something they cannot use just to be part of this. I would think about the ShipFast University, man. I really, like, you don't even need, you could sell a membership. You could sell a monthly membership to that community. And people would probably pay it if it's not too high, right? Particularly if it doesn't come with the code. But if it comes with the code, then now all of a sudden you have an LTV that is 3-4 digits if you, you know, bundle it with the price. That's kind of nice. I think that's just pretty cool. And you're a charismatic guy. Like, you could get people to come in. You already know how to launch things and how to drum up some interest. Well, I think that would be cool. Sorry for turning this podcast episode into a consulting session, but that's, I think you asked, so that's what you get.
Man, that was nice. I was typing a little new line on my to-do list for ShipFast. I appreciate it,
awesome.
Man.
I appreciate it too. Thanks for asking me. I think it's nice to think about where things can go, right? Because that's what indie hackers do. We build something and we say, well, what can we do? What else can we do? How can we help these people more? I think I really enjoy this. And you having built so many things, go ahead.
I just want to say that when you were talking about the community for ShipFast, I could see sparks in your eyes, the founder sparks in your eyes. We have a new business idea in mind. And you start to imagine the entire roadmap of it. Yes. It's like, this is going to be like this and like that.
Yeah.
This is beautiful, man.
and it is, you know, yes, it really is. I've been experiencing this over the last couple of weeks building my own thing. It's just you all of a sudden you see something that doesn't exist, but you see it. I think that's one of the most wonderful feelings that you can have. And I find it really cool that your software that you sell with ShipFast is facilitating that for other people. I think you're doing the community a great service in having this out there. And I know you have competitors, and I know people could just learn how to code and do it all by themselves, but that is also competition, like a job to be done kind of competition, right? But what you're doing, in particularly in building this community around it, is just drawing this massive moat around this project. I think that's a really, really smart choice that you've done there. It's really cool. What else are you working on? Are you fully focused on SendVoice now, or are you still like, how do you distribute your time? That's what I want to know, because I see like 3 or 4 things in your Twitter bio, all of which probably take some maintenance. How do you prioritize these things right now?
So this is new this year. I have 5 days allocated for building stuff. So from Monday to Friday, where I'm offline most of the day, and then I come online at 4 or 5 p.m., browse a little bit Twitter, go to bed, and start again the next day. And I allocate my weekend, so Saturdays and Sunday, for content creation. Saturday would be for I just started the YouTube channel, where I try to do exactly the same as I used to do, as I did on Twitter, and I'm still doing it. But with the videos, it's taking a lot of time, and I'm not, used to making an entire 10 minutes YouTube video in one day, but I'm trying my best. And Sunday would be for writing the newsletter and a couple tweets related to that newsletter.
Okay. Wow. That sounds like you have a full week. How do you balance, like work-life balance? I don't think for founders really exists, but I think we call this work-life integration at some point, right? Where it all kind of flows into each other. Do you do other things as well, other than like coding and writing content and now doing videos? Like, how do you balance this in your life?
Yes. I surf every morning. I wake up, drink a coffee and go to the beach, spend 2 hours, spread some energy, get some sun. Then I will go home, have a coffee and read a book for, I don't know, 30 minutes usually, and get breakfast after that. Then I start the day and I work and I finish around 6, I would say. And then with my wife, we'll go out, find a local restaurants, chat there. I recently set up this little guest room on the back where I have a PS4. I just received my new speaker. So
nice.
Kind of like your office, a bit sketchy version of your office right now.
I love it. That's really cool. Yeah, that's nice. Well, that sounds like you figured out a balance. I love I love your discipline, because when I wake up, I've been thinking, like, while I slept, about some weird coding issue or, you know, something that I really want to talk about. To be able to go and surf and have a coffee and read before you work, congrats, man. That's discipline right there.
So for you, the struggle is in the morning.
Yes.
It's like you wake up and you have those ideas and you have to put them to work, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
That's fun. For me, mornings are okay. I wake up, I'm like, fine, like, work is gone. But the problem is, if I wake up in the middle of the night, then I'm dead. That's why I try to not drink water before going to bed, like at least 3 hours before, because if I wake up to go to the toilet and my brain starts to think about work, man, 2 hours, like in the bed, I spend 2 hours debugging some code or imagining features or talking about that small community thing for ShipFast.
I mean, I get that. I understand, like I'm trying to keep it out of my evenings for that same reason, right? Like I could work until midnight and then go to bed and then go back to work. Like I'm at a stage with my thing. Like I have my first customers and I have really good feedback cycles and all that. I could work forever and there would always be something to do. But I have learned over the last couple of years, particularly after selling this business because of my burnout and my high anxiety, that I don't need that. Like, I literally don't need that in my life, right? This is something that should stay out of there. So the best thing that we have done is get a puppy. We have a dog and I'm the one that walks her in the morning. So when I get up, I cannot go to work because first off, I'm woken up by the puppy. The puppy comes into the bed and just like, yeah, I'm hungry. That's how that happens, right? So I have to feed the puppy and then I have to walk the puppy. And something magical happened there ever since I started walking her. My brain just, it dumps all of the random stuff. That it's like journaling. Some people journal in the morning. I go on a walk with my dog and it just empties the trash, you know, the empty trash button. That's the walk for me in the morning. And then I come back home. The puppy is happy because she did everything she wanted to do. She sniffed the whole neighborhood. It's very fun. And we have this bonding time with each other. So that's good for my heart. And then I get my coffee and I go downstairs and I start working. I think I've been much more productive ever since I've done this compared to before, where I would wake up, go right to work and, like, you know, find my way from sleep mode into work mode in front of my computer. This little interruption, you surfing, me the puppy, I think that makes a big difference. I think that's really helpful.
Yeah. And you say more productive. I think you also produce better quality work because your brain is fresh. It's like thinking 100% of that thing. So I think it's, what time do you usually close your computer?
We have figured out that somewhere around 5 or 6, we're both done. Like Danielle works from home. She's an audio engineer. So she edits and does like audio work. And she's done at 5 or 6 most of the time. She closes her computer. I tend to close my computer. I mean, I don't close my computer. I have a Mac Studio. I just walk away, right? The studio is my workspace, right? Right next to it is my coding space. This is my talking space. I close this door and I'm done with work. I try not to take it. I'm in the basement. I try not to take it upstairs. That's the idea. So it really helps. Honestly, that's one of the things also that I learned. First off, get a puppy. Everybody get a puppy. The second thing is put a door between your work and your non-work life. Like physically locate your work away from where you live, right? Don't put your work in your bedroom or your living room. Don't take your laptop. Don't do what Peter Levels probably does and just work from the couch. No diss to Peter, obviously. He does a great job at, you know, whatever he does. But I have found for me, taking the work with me is not a good idea. I need a designated space for it. And that's what the studio is for me.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. That's a new experiment for me this year. Last year, I would work until I had to go to bed. And it was doing well because everything was growing. But then as soon as things become steady or worse, things start to decline. Man, that's your brain is like total fucked up. So I really try to have, as you said, like office, I close the door and I'm good for the day. 6 p.m. is also the time limit for us. So yeah, good. I will also put you in the category of, you know, you have a really nice beard. You have a puppy. I would put you in the same category as Danny Postma.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Two founders who found a good life, work-life balance.
Yeah. Beautiful. I talked to Danny on this podcast just about the same thing as well. Like, we were exchanging information about our dogs because we wanted to know, like, you know, just dog parents talking about their puppies on a podcast, obviously. But yeah, that's the thing. I had this conversation with Danielle earlier. We were out walking the dog, like in an evening walk, and we were talking about, well, when do indie hackers stop spending all their time on their businesses? Right? When is that? Is it a phase where you do this, where you focus, you grind every day, hours, hours, hours from waking up until you sleep? And Danielle was saying, yeah, well, I guess it's when things start working out, right? When you have revenue coming in, then you have the luxury of not working full time on your thing. You can start surfing and you can, you know, can start reading books and stuff because you have a stable financial situation. How was that for you? Before you were successful with your products, were you like grinding 24/7?
Yes. I'm still quite healthy. I would always sleep 8 to 9 hours. I would always go to surf, but I would not have this moment at night where I close the computer at 6 and I enjoy 3 hours of free time with my wife going out for dinner. I would just somehow work, even though Twitter is not proper work, I would still be on Twitter and be around.
It is somehow proper work. I think it is. I mean, we put in a lot of effort to make things nice on Twitter. But yeah, it is not work that feels like work, right? It's kind of leisurely. Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, I'm glad that's not the case anymore, man, because that can quickly, this can damage relationships too, right? It can damage your relationship with your partner. If you have kids, you neglect them, even the relationship with yourself. If all you do is work, 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 and you don't allow yourself to find, you know, recreational joy in other things, stress, anxiety, these things happen. So I'm glad that you and I, we both speak for taking time off work, even if work is interesting, right? Yeah, that's a pretty important thing.
I'm curious if you enjoy anything besides spending time with your girlfriend or working out with your dog. If there's anything that you really enjoy in life, like really, really enjoy at a point where it's like almost addictive.
Cooking. I love cooking. Cooking to me as an activity is something that I just love. Like I will make a roast, I will make a risotto, I will make like really fancy pasta, really pestos, all kinds of things. I just love making things that I enjoy eating and that other people enjoy eating. Whenever we have people over, which we try because we live in a really small town in Canada. I moved here with Danielle to be close to her family, and it's a pretty sizable family. She has lots of friends. Whenever we have people over, I try to make an amazing meal. We try to make an amazing meal. And I just love that. I bake, I cook, I do all kinds of things. That, to me, that is it's almost like coding because it's literally an ingredient list and you do step by step, right? It's like, it's source code. You have your variables and you loop over that thing and, you know, it functions and you transform ingredients from one data type into the other. But it is such a physical thing where you get immediate feedback from the product. That's quite different from virtual things. So I love this. I also love painting miniatures. That's my other hobby. Right? I'm a big Warhammer nerd. That's kind of the world that I come from. Right? See what is behind this here, I have like an airbrush and like all kinds of brushes and all kinds of acrylic colors. My studio is the man cave of the nerd. I have the studio here, my computer over there, and there's my Warhammer painting station right over there behind you. So that's what I love.
Really appreciate you send me a picture after the podcast because I used to do the same thing.
Do. Wow. Why did you stop? Was it too expensive? Because that tends to be a problem.
It could be. Yeah. That might be. Right? I think since I started to code, I put all my attention to that. But now it's kind of new. I'm trying to find some hobbies and stuff that I can do outside of work to disconnect. And that could actually be one of them.
I recommend it. Like, to me, I have a 3D printer too. I let me be honest. I have three 3D printers, two resin printers and one FDM printer. And I've been like printing miniatures and, you know, understanding how all of the chemistry and the physics of that works. And I've been painting them. It's just trying to nerd out on a different level, right? Something that is for me, exclusively for me. I don't do this in public. This is a personal thing, but I need it to connect with my physicality because all I do is write about abstract things and talk with people like you. I love talking, but you're just this tiny little thing on my screen, right? Like, you're not physically present here. I need something that allows me to feel the physicality of my life. So that's what cooking does, and that's what painting miniatures does too. Do you have any hobbies other than surfing that give you like a physical thing in your life?
Not really. I was super excited when I was making up this room to just, you know, put the furniture here and add this speaker there. I love work, like working, spreading some, I love sweating. It's not sexy to say like that, but I love working out.
Yeah. Well, that's also great. That's pretty much it. I think, hey, Peter always says you got to lift, right? Are you lifting? Are you lifting enough? What do you think?
Not at all. I am a outdoor, I'm more like a play person. I tried to go to the gym. I just really, it's not, I don't like it. So skates and surf work well for me.
I have a home gym and I don't use it. It's like right over there too. Nah, doesn't work. That's just me being lazy, but I'm also not that kind of thing. I'm not that kind of personality, but maybe that's the thing. If you prioritize it, you make it happen. And if you can't prioritize it, you need to find something that you will willingly prioritize in your life. And I see you do this with surfing. If that is something you really enjoy, you make time for it, right? That's how that happens.
Yeah, sometimes learning how to just listen and not forcing, it could be a great teacher.
I think so too. And I think it's an important priority to choose in your life. Like, as a solopreneur, as an indie hacker, like, we are so focused on our the technical parts of our lives because that's what everybody talks about, right? Like, in the community, I think until like the last couple of years, the indie hacking community was all about code. It was all about, like, you know, JavaScript frameworks and all about like Stripe integrations and that stuff. And I mean, we all laugh about it, that the whole Peter Levels deadlifting comments and that kind of stuff. It's all funny in a way, but I'm really glad that he's bringing this into the conversation, that he's talking about healthy eating, that he's talking about like healthy way of living, that this weird obsession with calculating the carbon dioxide, chemicals in his rooms and stuff. I think it's important to take care of your surroundings and of yourself, of your body and your life. So I'm glad to see you do it. And I think to talk about it too, not just productivity, right? Not just like how to be more effective with your business, but also how to live a fuller life. I think you're a good example for this as well. So thank you for doing this in public as well. I think it's really cool.
I appreciate it, yeah. Yeah, Peter is doing a great job at leading the indie hacking's movement and still, after all those years, showing us how to do things.
I think you are doing this too. I think, like, let's not forget that you have, what is it, like probably 1/4 of Peter's following now on Twitter. Right? Is it like maybe 20% or so? That is pretty significant. Think about that. Right? Peter's been doing this for a decade now, right? It's pretty sizable. So you're still hanging out in Bali, right? Are you a slow-mad? Is that what you are?
Yes, 6 years in Bali and almost 5 years in this house, so barely moving anyhow, yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. That's not nomading at all. Do you ever see yourself like taking up the nomad life again, or are you just done? Are you just settling now?
We have a plan to buy hopefully a Cybertruck if it becomes available in Europe and do a Europe tour from Norway to, it's not Europe anymore, but Morocco.
Yeah. Well, close, right? I mean, they're not going to like it, but yeah, this is very close to you. That's really cool. Yeah, that's awesome. That is really fun. And then after that, you're going to go back to Bali? I just want to know, do you feel like you have a place that is home at this point in Bali, or is Bali still like, you know, like the foreign place, like the vacation-y kind of phase of your life kind of place?
It feels like home. And I feel so good when I'm back from my home country, France, to Bali. I feel like I'm actually back home. The only thing is hard to make a big commitment and buy a house here because things move really fast. With what happened with the war in Russia, you have a bunch of people coming. And so they start to build things everywhere. So that creates some kind of like random events that I'm not sure I want to deal with. That's why we struggle for now to commit to Bali for the long term. And we keep renting this villa. Every year we renew the contract.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I guess It is a volatile place. Sorry, things change pretty quickly. Like I'm not that versed in it. What I know is that laws change quite often, and the relationship with foreigners and what they can do and all that is always a bit problematic and unplannable, I guess. So very interesting. Well, I guess your Cybertruck tour is going to be interesting. Are you going to do that in public too? Are you going to share that journey if you do it?
I'll probably still build in the Cybertruck.
Ah, that's awesome. Oh man, that's cool. You got to put like a Starlink on top and just kind of build from the driving vehicle.
live stream it. Probably the car will drive itself, and I'll be building live stream awesome. While being driven by the car.
Oh, that is so cool. Yeah, I don't own a vehicle. We only have one in our household, but if I ever were to buy one, it would probably be the Cybertruck. I think it's just such a fun vehicle. Big fan of like 80s sci-fi style, and that car or that truck is just the most wonderful example of this. Man, I am looking forward to seeing you drive the Cybertruck all through Europe. That's going to be awesome. Man, if people want to find you and follow you on your journey, both the journey of you building indie products and building SaaS business, maybe communities, hopefully in the future, where do you want them to go?
Would be marklou.com, my website, marclou.com. I have my Twitter where I share everything I do in public, my YouTube channel, which is pretty new, and all my startups and revenue that are shared there.
Yeah, I highly recommend following your journey. I'm a big fan. And in case you haven't noticed, I'm a huge fan of you and your work. And I really appreciate you talking to me about it and sharing all of these insights, both into your life, into your personal approach on how to live and balance your life. That was really interesting to hear. And just how awesome you are at building things. That's always wonderful to see. Thank you so much for being on the show today. I am really, really happy we got to talk.
Thanks for having me, Arvid. I really enjoyed the podcast, and enjoy also following your journey since the beginning and got inspired by everything that you've done. Thank you.
Thanks so much. And that's it for today. I will now briefly thank my sponsor, Acquire.com. Imagine this. You're a founder who's built a really solid SaaS product. You acquired all those customers, and everything is generating really consistent monthly recurring revenue. That's the dream of every SaaS founder, right? Problem is, you're not growing for whatever reason. Maybe it's lack of skill or lack of focus or lack of interest. You don't know. You just feel stuck in your business with your business. What should you do? Well, the story that I would like to hear is that you buckled down, you reignited the fire, and you started working on the business, not just in the business. And all those things you did, like audience building and marketing and sales and outreach, they really helped you to go down this road, 6 months down the road, making all that money. You tripled your revenue and you have this hyper successful business. That is the dream. The reality, unfortunately, is not as simple as this. And the situation that you might find yourself in is looking different for every single founder who is facing this crossroad. This problem is common, but it looks different every time. But what doesn't look different every time is the story that here just ends up being one of inaction and stagnation, because the business becomes less and less valuable over time and then eventually completely worthless if you don't do anything. So if you find yourself here already at this point, or you think your story is likely headed down a similar road, I would consider a third option, and that is selling your business on Acquire.com. Because you capitalizing on the value of your time today is a pretty smart move. It's certainly better than not doing anything. And Acquire.com is free to list. They've helped hundreds of founders already. Just go check it out at try.acquire.com/Arvid. Me, and see for yourself if this is the right option for you, your business at this time. You might just want to wait a bit and see if it works out half a year from now or a year from now. Just check it out. It's always good to be in the know. Thank you for listening to the Bootstrap Founder today. I really appreciate that. You can find me on Twitter at Arvid Kahl, A-R-V-I-D-K-A-H-L, and you'll find my books and my Twitter course there too. If you want to support me and this show, please subscribe to my YouTube channel, get the podcast in your podcast player of choice, whatever that might be. Do let me know. It would be interesting to see. And leave a rating and a review by going to ratethispodcast.com/founder. It really makes a big difference if you show up there, because then this podcast shows up in other people's feeds. And that's, I think, where we all would like it to be, just helping other people learn and see and understand new things. Any of this will help the show. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day, and bye-bye.